This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we'll talk with one of the founders of Cure Autism Now, Portia Iverson. Portia Iverson has a son with autism. With the help of another mother whose son is autistic, Iverson began teaching her nonverbal son to communicate. Portia Iverson tells their story in the new book, Strange Son, Two Mothers, Two Sons, and the Quest to Unlock the Hidden World of Autism. The second mother and son are Soma Mukhopadhyay and her son Tito. They are from India. Portia Iverson and her husband, John Shestack, are the founders of Cure Autism Now. They founded the organization to help their son, Dove, and other children with autism. Since hearing the diagnosis of autism when Dove was 18 months old, the couple had worked tirelessly to help their son, but it wasn't enough. They wanted a better life for their son, and they wanted more research done on autism. In the course of setting up the foundation, they heard about Tito and his mother, Soma. Soma had developed a method for teaching her son. It involved an alphabet board. Tito could communicate by pointing at letters on the board. Could that help Dove? Portia Iverson knew she had to meet this mother and son. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Portia Iverson is an Emmy Award-winning art director. She has also worked as a sitcom writer and a set decorator. She and her family live in Los Angeles. She grew up here in Urbana, Illinois. Strange Son, Two Mothers, Two Sons, and the Quest to Unlock the Hidden World of Autism is published by Riverhead Books. Again, the phone number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Portia, greetings from Urbana.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm just thrilled to be on the show, and I was just so delighted when I saw it was WILL, which was my favorite station, my family's favorite station when we lived there.
All right. And you guys are big NPR listeners.
Yes.
Well, tell us here at the outset how it was that you began to worry about your son.
Well, Dove seemed like a perfectly normal baby. And when he was somewhere between 1 and 1.5, something really strange started to happen, which is it seemed like he wasn't responding to me calling his name. He wasn't looking at me, making eye contact. And I just remember one day I was sitting and I was calling out his name. He was sitting in a high chair, and I thought, what is he staring at? And I saw he was staring at a pattern of leaves, the light coming between the leaves in our kitchen window. And I thought, wow, he's really in a world of his own. And when those words crossed my mind, I knew something was wrong.
Yeah. Now, in autism, there's a range of abilities, a range of disability. This is called a spectrum disorder.
Yes.
What should we know about what autism is?
Well, there's several things to know. First of all, it's a developmental disorder. It happens early in life. It's usually diagnosed before the age of 3. The brain kind of goes off track somehow in the ability to interact and relate to people. The causes are unknown. Scientists are working very hard on that question. They do know that genes are involved. And there's also been a huge increase in autism in the last 10 years.
Hmm. Are we getting any closer to learning what the cause or causes are?
Yes, I think so. Because when my husband, John Shestack, and I started the Cure Autism Now Foundation, there was almost no research going on. This was 12 years ago. And today, some of the best people in neuroscience have gotten on board. The government has increased the funding quite a bit, though not enough. And people say, who've you know been around for a while, that they've never seen a field take off so fast as this. So there's a tremendous growing interest and and a huge increase in the amount of research going on. However, it is a very, very puzzling disorder, not an easy one to figure out. So, you know, it's very hopeful right now because at least there is a tremendous amount of research going on.
How is the diagnosis made?
Well, interestingly and sadly, there is not a blood test yet or a genetic test or anything like that. So it's made by observing behavior, and there are some standardized tests that you can, you know, a developmental pediatrician can administer. And, you know, usually the diagnosis is correct if the child, you know, seems to be autistic according to those scales. But there really is no absolute way to know, and that can be heartbreaking for parents because, you know, something is wrong with your child. You go in and you want to know definitively, you know, with a 1.5-year-old, is he autistic? Is, you know, what's wrong? And a doctor will say, well, you know, yes, he's autistic, but, you know, he could grow out of it or he could get worse or, you know, and it's you really want an answer, but really you can't really get an answer.
Speaking of wanting an answer, this has got to be a question that people want an answer to. Why an increase?
Right. Well, what scientists think, and, you know, it's probably the case, is since there are genes involved and yet it is increasing, it's probably a gene-environment interaction. And what that means is that you are genetically susceptible in your family, and there are things now, environmental factors, that interact with those genes to cause the disorder. So an example of that, another kind of example, would be diabetes, for example. Like, there's a huge increase. It's genetic. So there aren't more people with the genes. It's just that we're eating so much more sugar. There's you know, that would be considered an environmental cause, interacting with genes that make you susceptible.
What was life like for Dove, you and your husband, in the early years of his life?
Well, the very early years, you know, we were in a desperate struggle to get every kind of treatment there was, anything we heard of. There wasn't a whole lot, but we tried everything. And, you know, it is a spectrum disorder, as you mentioned. And so there was the hope that, you know, at the very least, if he didn't come out of it, if he didn't get over it, which very few children do, that he would be on the higher end of the spectrum. Well, that didn't, that wasn't the case. By the time he was 3, I actually had therapists giving up on him and saying, well, I don't want to see him anymore because he's not improving and there are people on my waiting list. So you can imagine how that makes you feel. So in the very beginning, you know, once we'd sort of run our way through all these therapies, you know, about a year into it, my husband said, you know, we have to start a research foundation. And to be honest, I didn't really know what that meant at the time. I know a lot about it now, but he realized that we had to get the government to put money into this and to get scientists to be working on it. And he realized that that was the best thing we could do for Dove.
What an interesting light bulb experience that must have been for you and your husband. For him first, how did this idea begin to take shape with him?
Well, really, I think that just seeing that first year of, you know, using all the money we had and all the time we had and trying all those different therapies and seeing that none of them, you know, it's not that they weren't helpful, but none of them was going to make the kind of difference that we wanted to see. And then what else was there? And we realized very quickly and were shocked by the fact that there was almost no money in the field of autism. There was $5 million a year being spent. Well, if the government, you know, was spending that, the disorder was costing the nation, conservatively estimating, $13 billion a year. So it was very disproportionate. And this was because for the first 50 years after autism was first described, scientists mistakenly blamed it on bad parenting. So there was a terrible relationship and lack of trust between researchers and parents.
John took on the business of politics and you took on the science. Neither of you had experience in either field. What was the learning curve like?
Well, it was huge, but, you know, I think any parent can relate to this, that when it's your child and it's a kind of life and death situation, you know, motivation isn't even the right word. You just naturally learn. John had always loved politics, so, and he was particularly good at it, a good speaker, a good speechwriter, and kind of a good political mover and shaker. And But I, in the science, I mean, no one was as surprised as I was, you know, and, you know, I avoided science all through Urbana Junior High and high school as much as I could and through college because I just wasn't good at it. And then suddenly it was the most interesting thing in the world to me because we were told that autism was incurable. We were told by the first professional we talked to that we should hold on to each other and, you know, get on with our lives. And we found that unacceptable, particularly when I saw that there was almost no research that had been done. Why were they so sure it was incurable? And this led me to want to understand science so I could know for myself what kind of chance there was of finding treatment and a cure for this disorder.
Yeah. Now, your husband, John, is a producer, and I mm-hmm. imagine that was a great help to him, you know, how to put things yes. together.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and he and I knew, you know, we knew that we had friends here in Hollywood who were celebrities and that they would help us and that this disorder had no spokesperson up till that time. So that's what we did. And also, you're right, he really knew how to get a project done. And, you know, he used to always say, you know, people would say, oh, you can't just throw money at this. And he would say, yes, you can. That's what you do in business. It's what you do in the movies. So, you know, throw money at it. It'll work. And it has.
Yeah. You say that when you began Cure Autism Now, you were, to use your words, you were sure that the unrelenting insistence on a better life for Dove seemed absurd to many people. And you met resistance from people working in the field, professionals. What kind of resistance did you encounter?
Well, there's this, I still meet that resistance today. There's a feeling that you shouldn't give people false hope. And my husband and I, you know, one of the first things we really thought about and agreed on and said this is almost our motto was, you know, there is no such thing as false hope. There's only hope. And, you know, without that hope and without a higher expectation for that child, you know, they're not going to go anywhere. So I think there was also resistance, well, for other reasons, too. You know, if you're a researcher or a doctor and you've built your career around the idea that this is untreatable, you know, incurable, the kids are 80% of them are retarded, that figure is still being thrown around today, and you find out you were wrong, you know, that's probably not too much fun. Likewise, if you were one of these professionals and you came to find out that many more of these children were cognitively intact and, in fact, weren't retarded, and you'd been, you know, talking in front of them as if they couldn't understand you for all these years, that wouldn't be such a good feeling either. So I think there's a lot of reasons for the resistance.
You were criticized for the foundation's name. Mm-hmm. How did you select the name, and how did you answer your critics?
Well, it was so simple. I mean, we just said what we wanted, Cure Autism Now. You know, and I remember one time at a board meeting internally we were debating, and some people said, well, you know, how can we have this long-term sustainability with a name like Cure Autism Now? And, you know, I said, well, you know what? We want to cure autism now, but we're going to be in it for however long it takes. And that's really it in a nutshell, and that's what I would tell people. You know, I don't want a name like a Cure Autism Maybe Someday, right? So, again, it's the high expectation that leads you to, you know, the goal.
Yeah. When and how did you hear about Soma and Tito?
Well, actually, Dove, you know, he's nonverbal. He can't speak, and he's considered severely affected. And we really weren't able to communicate with him and the first 9 years of his life. And so, you know, we had our foundation, Cure Autism Now, and the research was going well. But, you know, every night when we came home, here was Dove, as autistic as ever, needing care 24/7 and unable to communicate. And it was through a conference that I put on for the foundation about attention and arousal and autism. I met a British psychiatrist, and she said, you know, I've met this boy in England. His name is Tito. He came to England with his mother from India. His mother's name is Soma. And she has taught him how to read and write, and even though he is severely autistic in every way and has been diagnosed by our psychiatrist and psychologist, so we have no doubt that he's autistic, he has a high IQ, and he's literate, and he can basically communicate, tell us how he feels, what he thinks, you know, and explain things. And he even writes poetry. Well, this seemed like, you know, how could this be true? You know, everything I'd been told was quite the opposite. So that's how I first heard of them.
Yeah. Well, tell us about Soma and what inspired her approach to teaching her son.
Soma is a very unique and gifted person. It's kind of ironic that, you know, while I was over here in the United States, you know, with the foundation and everything, she was basically in India with a piece of cardboard with the alphabet on it. And she was really kind of a genius in what she did. She took her son. She basically lived, the two of them lived by themselves. She worked with him, you know, just continuously. That's all she did. And she was determined that, you know, he wouldn't stay in the labeled as mentally retarded, and that she was going to teach him. So the first thing she did was she saw him. She noticed he was obsessively staring at numbers on the calendar. He just, you know, that was what he did. Now, most people would say, that's not normal behavior. Stop that. But what she thought instead was, wow, this is really capturing his attention. Let me see what I can do. So she took him and she taught him to point, and I mean really just took his hand and his finger, put it on the number one, and said, can you do this? And he did it, and then, and so on. And so then she said, next step, let's see if you can tell me what's between the number one and three. And when he could answer by pointing at two, she knew she was on to something, and she went ahead and was able to teach him the numbers up to 100 just in the course of a few days. And then after that, she realized, well, why not the alphabet? She taught him the alphabet, and then she attached sounds, just plain old phonics, you know, sounds to each letter. And in that way, he became literate, and that was the beginning of his being able to communicate.
Mm. And what has he had to say about what his inner life is like?
Well, this was so revealing. Once I, you know, tracked down Soma and Tito, which was not easy in India, they came to the United States briefly. We at Cure Autism Now, we have a group called Innovative Technology for Autism, and we were having a conference, and I invited them to be the keynote speakers. And I, you know, I didn't know what would happen, but I had a video of Tito, so I figured if he couldn't handle it being up on the stage or whatever, that I had that to, you know, in the wings. They came over, and you know, when I first heard of them, of course, I was skeptical. I mean, I was hoping he was for real, but when they came over and I saw that he really was, you know, everything that I had been told, I realized that we basically had a Rosetta Stone of autism on our hands. I mean, here was someone who was so, you know, so-called low-functioning behaviorally and yet could really describe what was going on, and I began, that was the beginning of my relationship with Tito, in which I interviewed him extensively and brought them back actually to stay in the United States for a couple of years, and brought Tito to various neuroscientists around the country to study him, and he revealed incredible things. For example, it turned out that he really couldn't see and hear at the same time, and this was largely a function of his attention. The more he concentrated, the more his senses got separated, and he explained it to me this way. He said that when he was little, things would go together that shouldn't. So he was like in such a heightened state that if he was looking at a cloud, someone said the word banana, they would go together. He couldn't get them apart, and he couldn't even make sense of the world. So he began instead to just look up and not look at things and just to listen, because when he heard things and didn't pay attention to what he saw, he could understand things better. And over years, this grew, you know, to be more and more of the way his brain worked. He basically rewired it, I mean, not intentionally. And this is one of the things we discovered. And, you know, you can imagine the implications of this. Most of the therapies, the first thing you do is you say, look at me. And he says that if he looks at you, you know, he can't hear you. So, and my son Dove is the same way, actually. The more interested he is in paying attention to you, the more he'll turn his head away from you. I actually explained to him recently, I said, you know, people know that you're interested in them and listening if you look at their eyes. So, you know, even if it doesn't work for you, just try to give someone a little glance so they don't think you're just ignoring them. Now he does that.
That's interesting. Well, you know, sometimes if I'm really concentrating and I'm trying to communicate with someone about something that is very important, I might try and, you know, shut out the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Close my eyes.
Mm-hmm. This is exactly what it is, times a thousand, to the point where Tito and my son Dove, I would call them, you know, functionally almost blind because they really don't use their eyes when they're using their ears.
Hmm. Is this typical, as we mentioned before? This is, you know, we're talking after all about individual people, mm-hmm. and there can be such a great range of
right.
of abilities and disabilities. Is this typical? Is this something that we can say of all autistic people, or
well,
is there
I think,
a lot of difference?
Yeah, there is a big range of kinds of autism, and I think there's another type of autistic person who uses their eyes almost exclusively. And this, again, it's just a matter of adaptation. You know, early in life, what we all do it, what gets you the most information? Like if you or I are in an airport and it's loud, we will actually begin lip reading unconsciously. In other words, we'll start staring at someone's mouth because it's giving us more information. You know, our senses basically dial up or down and go together or not according to giving us whatever yields the best quality information to us. And so typical people do this, and autistic people do too. And I'm sure you've heard of Temple Grandin, who is a very high-functioning autistic person who has a PhD, and actually she went to the U of I.
Mm-hmm.
And Temple I've interviewed a lot too, and she describes her world as all pictures. So it's really the same sort of thing, but with a different kind of, using a different channel. So she came to rely very heavily on her eyes and vision and picture language, and Tito came to rely very heavily on auditory language, and to the point of really ignoring, you know, his vision. So I how common it is, I think it's very common. And the reason why is that, at first when Soma and Tito came over, I really, my biggest hope was to learn more about autism through Tito by what he could tell us, and especially when scientists who really knew what they were doing could test him and question him. But, you know, in the back of my mind as a parent, of course, you know, I held this hope, like maybe Dove could have this kind, maybe he wouldn't be a poet, but, you know, maybe he was smarter than we thought. But on the other hand, you know, with a severely autistic child, it takes literally years to teach such basic skills, you know, for example, you know, putting on your shoes or, you know, getting food from the fridge. Just basic things can take so, so long. So just the thought, you know, the first time Soma and Tito came over, it was only for a two-week period, and then when they came back initially, it was going to be for 4 months. And I just figured she'd worked with Tito his whole life. He was 11 or 12 at the time. And here was Dove, already 9. He'd never had this type of intervention. So what were the chances, you know, that this could work for him, or that window of opportunity wasn't already over because he was older? So I was absolutely astonished when she worked with him for 6 weeks, 30 minutes a week, not a day, but once a week. And after that first six-week period, I really think she was trying to figure out what to do, because with Tito, of course, it was trial and error. And, you know, she had a fairly long period of time to work this out for him, but she'd never tried it with another child. She told me in India they wouldn't let her. She didn't have a degree, and they weren't going to let her work with anyone. So she was, you know, she was as eager as I was to try this out and see if Tito really was one in a million, or were there others. And it did work for Dove.
Yeah.
That was a life-changing event, and really that's mostly what my book is about, is how that happened and what it did and what it shows us. So she went on then to volunteer at Dove's school, and there were 9 children in his class, and within, let's see, I guess it was about 2 months, all those 9 children were pointing, and to one degree or another, you know, beginning to communicate, beginning to be able to answer questions, and some more than others, but all of them showed much greater cognitive ability than anyone had, you know, really even dreamed was possible.
Yeah. So now, is the way in which children with autism are taught, is it changing?
Is this not yet.
Not yet. Okay.
That's one of the
Why
great.
Not?
Yeah. Well, one of the great hopes for my book is that this will start to get this concept out there. Well, the model of autism, you know, has been that 80% are retarded. It's a lifelong disorder. It's incurable. And this information, you know, now, you know, through my book and a few other sources coming out that, you know, perhaps many, if not most of these children are in there intact. It doesn't mean they're not autistic, and it doesn't mean their behaviors are going to completely change. But I think, you know, the education system is struggling right now to deal with this big increase in autism, and they're overwhelmed because educating an autistic child is very labor-intensive, takes a lot of resources. And there isn't really so much known about what educational methods or even behavioral methods are more effective one than another. There's really hasn't been enough research. And so this is a whole new ball game. Like, I had to start a school for my son because there was nowhere to send him. Where do you send a kid who behaves like a 2-year-old and thinks like a 14-year-old? I had to design a program for him.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today is Portia Iverson. She has a son with autism, and with the help of another mother whose son is autistic, Iverson began teaching her nonverbal son to communicate. Portia tells their story in the new book, Strange Son, Two Mothers, Two Sons, and the Quest to Unlock the Hidden World of Autism. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with a question, with a comment. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. So tell us when it was and how it was that you realized that your son would be able to share with you the experience of his life through written language.
Well, as I said, you know, Selma and Tito were only supposed to be at that time in the United States for 4 months. They ended up staying quite a bit longer. In fact, they're still here. And during that period, I knew that Selma wanted to see if this could work on another kid. She was so enthusiastic and in a way desperate to try it because they hadn't let her in India. And, of course, I wished it would work, and I saw no harm in trying. So I took Dove over to her house, and she worked with him for 30 minutes, and she was holding onto his hand, and, you know, he was pointing at letters, but she was holding his hand, and I couldn't really tell, you know, was she guiding him it wasn't clear to me at all. I wasn't convinced, shall we say, but I wasn't unconvinced, but, you know, anybody could hold a kid's hand and make it point. So after that, Dove's one-on-one aide, who would take him to and from school, took him one day a week after school for 30 minutes. And, of course, I'll never forget this day because it was September 11th, 2001. Nobody was in school. And Dove went over to Soma's apartment to have a session. And that night, that afternoon when she brought him back, she said, you know, you've really got to come over because today Dove typed without Soma holding his hand or his arm at all. He actually pointed to letters and was spelling things out on his own. Well, when I heard that, of course, I was ready to take a look. And so the next day I went over and, you know, she wasn't talking about anything personal. She was teaching and testing. That's a method that she really uses most of the time with kids who are just starting out. So there's no pressure about, you know, explaining yourself, communicating, nothing, you know, you don't have to. You just start with something simple, what's a ball? Is it a toy or a food? You know, this type of thing, so that it's very easy, very low pressure. And but she was teaching him, you know, I would say about a third or fourth grade type of material. Now, Dove was 9, and keep in mind, you know, in the school system, he was in a pre-academic curriculum. This means like nursery school, you know, no reading, no writing, no math, really, you know, counting blocks, this type of thing. So I sat down, and she was teaching him about, the earth and stars and the sun and moon, just some basic stuff. But, you know, I thought, you know, this kid can't tell us, you know, can't point the difference between red and blue or 1, 2, 3. So, you know, this is way too advanced for him. And I remember she said, she was teaching, she said, a galaxy is a group of stars, and she was explaining it, and then she said, what is a galaxy? And he typed out, a galaxy is a group of stars, and that's the first thing that I saw him type, and I was astonished because she was not holding his hand or his elbow or his shoulder. She was, you know, prompting him along verbally, saying, come on, come on, which is part of this technique. These children are so pulled into the sensory environment continuously that you have to, it's almost like a metronome for their attention to keep them going and on track. And, you know, from there, she just kept teaching him and asking questions, and that was like a turning point in my life because, and it was hard to handle. I mean, it was like every parent's dream, and yet it was very, it was wonderful and kind of terrifying because it didn't make sense. You know, I mean, when you teach someone for years, you know, just some very, very basic things, and then suddenly you find out they know how to read already, and, you know, they can do basic math, arithmetic, and, you know, that they've understood everything you've said all along, it's a shock.
Let's take a call. A listener joins us now from Southern Illinois on line 4. Hi. Is there a caller there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I always have a question about the program that you were talking about. I've used the picture exchange communication system, and I was wondering if that is related to what you're discussing, and if there's a program that's like online that you can get to for that other people can implement with their children, possibly a similar technique. And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. What was the program she said she was using? Did you catch that?
A pictorial?
Oh, maybe it's a picture exchange.
It involves pictures. Okay.
We used that with Dove before he could communicate by pointing and typing. And it was a little bit useful. You know, he would give us, it's a little picture that's on a strip with Velcro, and you know, he would use it for a few food items that he wanted. But, of course, that's nothing like being able to, you know, say something, a sentence, or, you know, it's very limited. And she was asking if this is available. So Soma really invented this technique. She calls it the rapid prompting method. And Soma has a foundation of her own in Austin, Texas, called HALO, H-A-L-O. And it has a website, halo.org. And on there, they have some information. It's not a lot. But she also sees kids individually and gives training workshops for parents and teachers. And I have a website where I just put it up very recently, and I've written a fair amount about how to get going with how to get your child started communicating. You know, one of the most important things to think about and remember, I think, is, and actually this was Soma's motto in a way, she said, expect the absolute lowest level of ability when it comes to behavior and when it comes to motor abilities, and expect the highest when it comes to the cognitive and you know, how the mind works. And I found that very much to be true. So I think that, you know, this method, it isn't codified and routinized into a manual yet, like Braille or sign language, which is what I see it to be, as something on that kind of a scale. But it will be. And in the meantime, there's no reason why parents can't get started in trying it out. The main thing is you've got kids who, like my son Doe, for 9 years, he basically, even though he was, you know, with us, he was living in isolation among people because he had no way of connecting. And when you have a person, you know, who's been like that, if you think about it, you know, I think I read this in the paper the other day, they said the biggest thing associated with suicide, you know, in the services is solitary. Like if someone's impounded and they're isolated. And it's the same thing in the jails. You know, if somebody is kept from human contact, that's the biggest single cause for suicide. So if you think about a kid who's out of contact, even though they're around people, so they're learning, their brain's working, they're picking up on stuff, nobody knows what they know, they can't let you know, and, you know, it's not just what they can't do. Even worse is what they can't stop doing, all the obsessive and repetitive behaviors that just continuously get in the way. And what Soma's method does is it kind of just leapfrogs over those, and it teaches the child a very, very basics of how to point. I mean, the things we absolutely take for granted. You know, we would say, oh, you know, show me the letter A, and if the kid couldn't do it, we assume they don't know the letter A, but that turns out not to be true. They need to be taught the most rudimentary skills of communication, like just how to point at something. And but really, I think once you get going with this kind of joint attention, you know, I show the child A, you know, I show them how I point at it. I let them hold my hand while I point, while I'm narrating what I'm doing. Then I take their hand and I do it with them, and I narrate over that. And then I may just hold on to their elbow and let them do it, and so on. And it's that basic, but that's the way you get through to all the rest of it, because they've really been living in a parallel universe for their whole life if they can't communicate.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yeah, I have a friend who has an autistic child, and one of the things that, unless you are familiar with, you know, people that have autistic children, it's very demanding, you know, and from the standpoint of a parent. I wonder whether that, in terms of the increase in environmental contaminants, serves as maybe a catalyst, you know, for autism. The problem is we wouldn't know what contaminant. For example, when you take mercury, even though our government, doesn't take it seriously, very small amounts have a very damaging effect on children. So I just wonder whether this is a factor, not in mercury particularly, but whether this could be a causal relationship.
Well, I think there's a good chance that things like mercury, one of the biggest problems is that, you know, in our lifetime, you know, we've been exposed to, you know, thousands of environmental factors that no generation ever has before, and that makes it all the harder to pinpoint what's going on. And it could even, and probably is even more than one factor, combined with a genetic susceptibility. And you mentioned that this is very demanding for parents. I think autism is one of the absolute most demanding kinds of disorders for parents to deal with, and also think of the poor kids, you know, I mean, especially the ones like my son who, you know, are picking up on everything around them. People are talking about them like they're not there, saying they're retarded, and, you know, that's, you know, when I wrote the book, I felt like this huge responsibility, because once I saw, you know, my son begin to type, you know, I knew Tito wasn't one in a million, and I knew that two of them probably weren't two in a million. And when she volunteered at his school and the other kids began to type in, since then she's worked with hundreds of children. You know, once you see that, you really can't not do something. You know, I mean, I'm sure this was like Annie Sullivan in a way felt when Helen Keller had her breakthrough. You know, if this would work for her, maybe it'd work for others. And if it worked for others, you had to just keep going, because you couldn't sleep at night knowing that there were, you know, there's 1.5 million people with autism in our country. And a good deal of them probably are like this. So, you know, it's my aim to really try to get this out there and get scientists working on it more, get parents. The more parents can get their kid communicating, you know, the more evidence there will be out there that the children do have intelligence.
Let's talk with another caller, a listener on the toll-free line on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi there.
I was just listening to your program. It's very interesting, very informative, and the man who called a little while ago about the contaminants. My question about autism is there any research or any thought of giving any credibility to a connection between vaccinations and the onset of the various forms of autism? When your guest mentioned that her son was diagnosed between a year and a year and a half, it makes me wonder about those kinds of things. And I'll hang up and listen to anything she has to say about that. I'll be looking for your book, too, by the way.
Thank you. Well, a lot of parents have wondered this because, a lot of researchers and professionals argue that, well, you get a vaccine right during that developmental period where the kid, you know, if they're going to become autistic, you know, that's the same period of time, and it's coincidental. But then, you know, you hear so many parents that say, you know, I had a kid who was looking at me, he was talking, there wasn't a problem in the world, he got a vaccine, and, you know, a week later he was autistic. So, you know, when that happens to you, you know, you're pretty convinced that it was a vaccination. So, you know, there have been a number of studies, certainly not enough, and certainly not enough to draw a conclusion, but the biggest one took place in Denmark a few years ago. And those studies seem to indicate that vaccination was not to blame. However, there are so many confounding factors. Like, they know that genes are involved in autism, so let's say that only those with a genetic susceptibility would a vaccine trigger autism. I'm just making that up totally. But so you can see it's a very complicated issue, and really the government is who needs to get behind this because, like our foundation, Cure Autism Now, we fund about $10 million a year in autism research, but the kind of epidemiological study that needs to be done to show whether or not vaccines are involved is, you know, involves, you know, far more money than we could ever raise. So this is where the federal government really needs to step up to the plate.
Let's take another call. A listener in Rankin on line two. Hi.
Hi, ladies.
Hi.
I wanted to applaud Mrs. Iverson for the courage that she's taken in trying to get some resolution here. I've got a few questions for you. Have you tried simple things like restriction of milk and wheat?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have.
Okay. Did you notice any changes?
Well, you know, I think this varies from kid to kid, so I'm going to tell you what happened to us, but I don't mean to say that this would be everyone's experience. We took our son off dairy products and gluten when he was just about 2 years old. And as it turned out, the dairy products really didn't make much of a difference, but the gluten made a tremendous difference. He would just get, I don't know how else to put it, but much more autistic when he was on the gluten. And we kept him off of that till he was about 12 years old. And he really was, you know, we were very strict because if he got any gluten, that would just destroy his day. He would just be hyperactive, grinding his teeth, drooling, just, you know, having all these repetitive behaviors. So for him, it made a difference. I also think that he slept through the night much better when he was off gluten. By the time he was about 12, he got into it a few times, and it didn't seem to affect him anymore. He seemed to grow past that stage. It might be that it's much more important earlier on, but I think it's different. I think there are a lot of kids out there who, especially early on, would probably do better. It's not a cure by any means, but you know, you don't want to be giving the kids something that makes them their symptoms even worse. But
right.
it's not true for all.
And then when you were describing some of the observations of behavior and interaction with the environment, it just struck a chord with me that it was very similar to what's referred to as audio, visual, entrainment that can be caused by flashing lights and other stimuli. And I wondered if your organization looked into any of those kind of aspects.
Are you talking about that as a treatment or as a symptom?
Basically, I guess it's a double-edged sword. If somebody uses particular frequencies, you can actually induce things like seizures,
mm-hmm.
but it was more geared in these more modern times towards therapeutic uses because
mm-hmm.
it is supposed to induce relaxation,
mm-hmm.
which almost from the conversation that you were having
mm-hmm.
seems to be a key component in
right.
breaking through the confusion in the brain.
Is what you're describing, would you call that neurofeedback?
I'm not familiar with that term being used with it, but it very well could be.
So, you know, especially with kids who are on on the higher end of the spectrum, meaning that behaviorally they function a little better. Some things like EEG neurofeedback can be very helpful to help them begin to regulate their nervous system. With kids who are so-called lower functioning behaviorally, like my son,
mm-hmm.
It can be very hard to get them to cooperate with, you know, whatever's involved with that. It usually involves
right.
a lot of equipment and
right.
stuff. But I guess my answer really is that not a lot is known about it yet, but definitely these neural retraining techniques are going to play a very major role in treating autism in the future, because when we do uncover the genetic and metabolic and environmental causes, we're going to have people of all ages who've been living with a disorder, and they're going to need these kind of things.
Exactly. And then I have one last thing to ask you, and I'll ring off. Most of what I've read about chelation therapies for those like myself that think there are vaccine-related causation to this, they're very dangerous. And I was curious if you had looked at all into the vitamin B1 therapies.
Mm-hmm. I haven't really looked into the vitamin B1 therapies. I'm the kind of person where I'm willing to take a little bit of risk, of course, because autism itself is a big risk. But I need to have a pretty good scientific rationale, not proof, but reason for doing it. And so far, I haven't come up with any that would compel me to try that, although I'm open to learning.
Mm. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Portia Iverson, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. Do you mind if I mention my website?
Not at all, and we're going to put a link to it okay. on our website as well.
Great. It's www.strangesun.com, and I hope people will visit it.
Very good. Thank you so much. The
Thank
best
you.
To you and your family.
Thank you very much.
Portia Iverson has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Strange Son, Two Mothers, Two Sons, and the Quest to Unlock the Hidden World of Autism.